Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jimmy Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Last week, the death of Osama bin Laden dominated the headlines, and this week, his killing and its implications will continue to drive the agenda in Washington for the president and his foreign policy team. Of course, that means Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who had already been dealing with radical change across the globe, with revolution sweeping the Middle East in the weeks before, even as she worked to transform U.S. diplomacy at the ground level. By some accounts, she's logged 500,000 miles in her Boeing 757. In this month's Vanity Fair, Jonathan Alter explores the complex relationship between Hillary Clinton and President Obama, as well as what Clinton can and perhaps cannot accomplish as Secretary of State. Jonathan Alter joins me now. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing, Jamie?
I am well. How are you?
I'm great.
So, Jonathan, there's a whole lot here, about 7,000 words, so we're going to break it down. Let's talk first about who this woman is now that she is Secretary of State. I have to say, in the interest of full disclosure, I worked for Hillary Clinton a very long time ago, back in the 90s, on health care. She was a very different person then. How has she been transformed by this position?
Well, the most striking thing is how much less controversial she is than she used to be. Remember all the people in the media, outside the media, who kind of dined out on despising her? That's all gone now, or I certainly couldn't find any of it when I was researching this piece, and it's been replaced by a general agreement that she's a smart, effective, tireless, dutiful, and basically good Secretary of State. So it's partly because of an old tradition of politics kind of stopping at the water's edge in at least some cases when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. It's partly a function of President Obama and Nancy Pelosi becoming the objects of scorn on the American right. But it's also partly because she's doing a good job, and she's not yet a great Secretary of State in terms of history, but she's already clearly a very good one.
You write, and this is one of my favorite lines in the piece, quote, "Even as she navigates these choppy waters, Hillary's own vessel is solid and surprisingly leak-proof. One of the least noticed changes in American public life is how she has been transformed from a subject of constant gossip and calumny into a figure of consequence and little controversy." And I like this least noticed changes in American public life. I mean, how true is that? No one seems to have noticed that she sort of slipped into this role. And as you say, everyone used to gossip about her, dine out, as you put it, on picking on Hillary. And now she just goes about dutifully doing her job. But I suppose if there were a major misstep, Jonathan Alter, all of that could change.
Yeah, it could. And that's just the way the media works. And she hasn't been, you know, perfect on everything. I think they, in some ways, botched the rollout of the Libya attack. And only 17 days before Mubarak resigned, she described his regime as, quote, stable. So it's not a completely error-free performance, but I was just very impressed by her ability to stay on top of so many different subjects on so little sleep. When I would travel with her, I would get back and I would be completely exhausted. And she would be, you know, off to the Oval Office after we got back in the wee hours of the morning. And she would be, you know, fresh as a daisy. And it just it's not just her endurance. It's that she is just performing at a very high level of competence in terms of staying on top of a whole series of very subtle and complex issues.
Yeah, and we want to talk very specifically about Libya, about Egypt, certainly about Afghanistan and Iraq in the wake of the bin Laden killing. But let's first ask you about her relationship with President Obama. The Secretary of State, to be a success, has got to have a strong relationship with the president. Does she?
She does. She has a strong working relationship with him, and they meet several times a week. And he is delighted by the way it's worked out. He was taking a risk by naming her over the objections of his staff. She was very reluctant to take the job. And it's worked out much better than anybody had any reason to hope. They don't have a close personal relationship, and I discussed that with her some when I was interviewing her. And you know, she did mention a couple of occasions where they really connected personally. But I'm not sure that they need to. One of her people described her as, she said it's hard for. This aide said it's hard for her to break through to him sometimes, but she always has a shot with him. And that quote stuck in my mind because, it struck me that it's a long way from when they were running against each other that she has a shot with him now, a chance to get through to him and have her advice taken, which it is some of the time, and other times he goes his own way over her objections. For instance, on Afghanistan, she favored much more of a nation-building long-term commitment than he did. He wants to and will start de-escalating from Afghanistan in July of this year.
And let's begin talking about some of those specific foreign policy considerations. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Jonathan Alter. He is the author, of course, of The Promise. He is also a political analyst for MSNBC. And we are also joined now by Marwan Bishara, senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English, host of The Empire. It's the monthly show about global powers. Marwan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking, as I'm sure you've heard, about Hillary Clinton's role in the Obama administration. Your current piece is called Killing the Alibi, and in it you argue that Washington has less reason to wage war in Afghanistan now that bin Laden is no more. Explain.
Well, for a long time, some of us who looked at the situation in Afghanistan from the other side of the Atlantic were convinced that there were very few al-Qaeda elements in Afghanistan. They were mostly in Pakistan, and that al-Qaeda Central, meaning al-Qaeda that is managed through Pakistan, Afghanistan, was less effective and less influential than the various mutations of al-Qaeda, whether it's in the Arabian Peninsula or North Africa, et cetera, et cetera. But the voices from Washington were quite convinced that if only we get rid of bin Laden, if only we'll get rid of his senior lieutenants, then we will have less reason to stay in Afghanistan. And the only reason we are there at this long, perhaps the longest war in recent U.S. history, is because of bin Laden. Well, presumably, bin Laden has been killed, and now those voices need to come to terms with their own argument that there is far less reasons for the U.S. to be in Afghanistan.
And Marwan, has the State Department had anything to say on Afghanistan since the killing of bin Laden?
Well, most of the things that we at Al Jazeera have been covering is the big controversy within Pakistan and the various sometimes contradictory reports as to what happened and who assisted who in doing what and whether the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence services, were involved in this, and of course with the U.S. and the State Department asking for clarification on much of what has happened and so on and so forth. So now the new pretext, if you will, for U.S. national security in Afghanistan, Pakistan, is the Taliban, and more precisely the Taliban's relationship with certain elements of the Pakistan Secret Service. And hence, I'm afraid we might be up for another battle over the hearts and minds of Americans who, I mean, over whether the U.S. should remain engaged, because there is still much more to be done in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Which gets us to this video release, gentlemen, both of you. Marwan, let me come first to you on that, the video release. And for listeners who may have missed it, Marwan, please educate us. What exactly have we seen? Carefully curated, I think it's fair to say. And what message do you think the Obama administration is trying to send with what it chose to release to the world?
I'm not sure if you're talking about the bits that were edited from what the people in Washington were watching when the operation was carried.
No, I'm talking about the five videos that were released from the Obama, that President Obama chose to release from Osama bin Laden's camp.
Well, you know, I think for the time being, what we have is perhaps the last days of trying to explain what has happened rather than what will happen. I think we're still maybe at the point of culmination rather than at the point of a beginning, meaning I think a lot of what is happening now is more playing to the domestic agenda, where President Obama will go on to exploit the Afghan, the Al-Qaeda, the bin Laden issue for domestic, for elections purposes. And I think that's normal. That's politics, if you will, as usual. And I think he will, he will milk it all the way. And I think it will work for President Obama. But I don't think that's going to be helpful on the long term in terms of U.S. strategy in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that might lead to certain blowback on the short term, or maybe an intermediate run. At the end of the day, the U.S. will probably need to move beyond bin Laden, beyond video clips and videotapes, beyond lies and deception, if you will, even if we have to go that far, into a more serious strategy of disengagement from Afghanistan, Pakistan.
Jonathan Alter, it does seem that the U.S. is trying to send a very clear message to Al-Qaeda with what it chose to release, but that there are multiple messages that it intends to send, multiple audiences.
This was just fascinating to watch what they chose to release. I'm not quite sure what Marwan means by lies and deception. It struck me as more just very skillful decision-making, building on skillful decision-making when it came to getting bin Laden. First, they made a smart move in not releasing the gory pictures. Then the pictures they did release of bin Laden showed him as a pathetic old man without any power to do anything except watch himself on television and maybe change the channel. He looked as the image of him wrapped in that shawl reminded me of the shots of early photographs, some of the very first photojournalism of the dying president, Ulysses S. Grant. He was in precisely that pose without the television set in the 1870s. It's not exactly an image of strength. So if you're trying to convey to the world that Al-Qaeda is, poised to be dismantled and its other operatives rolled up, this was a smart use of imagery. And at the same time, they ran those images of him with a dyed beard. Nobody likes a guy who dyes his hair. And very smartly did not run into the audio so that the audio could not be used for Al-Qaeda recruitment. They just ran the video of him looking like, you're somebody with the equivalent of a bad toupee. So that had the effect of humiliating bin Laden, diminishing bin Laden and Al-Qaeda without what the president called, the trophy, the unseemly trophy of the bullet to the head shot. And I think the polls indicate that the American public approves of his decision not to do that. So
Yes. There
was some early bad information there that John Brennan revealed when it came to bin Laden being armed at the end, and some things that turned out not to be true. But by and large, this administration has had a fabulous week. And when you add some of the other things that have been going on with the Ryan plan on Medicare essentially collapsing with some good jobs numbers, with a quick response on the disaster in Alabama by the president a week ago. That doesn't assure he's going to get reelected. He has a lot of ways to lose, but he's in a much stronger position politically than he was just 10 days ago.
All right. And I want to be clear, the five videos that were released are just part of what was seized in that raid. There is a lot more data that was seized in the raid there in Pakistan. We're going to take a very quick break. My guests are going to stay with us. Jonathan Alter, who has a profile of Hillary Clinton in this month's Vanity Fair, also an analyst for MSNBC, and Marwan Bishara, senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English. We're going to continue to talk about Secretary of State Clinton and all of the international news right after this. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer, and I am joined by Jonathan Alter, of course, the author of The Promise, political analyst for MSNBC. And he is also the author of a new profile of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, which appears in this month's Vanity Fair. We are also joined by Marwan Bishara. He is a senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English. He's also the host of Empire. That's the monthly show about global powers. And I have to ask, and Jonathan, I'm going to come to you on this, about that now famous photo, that nearly iconic photo of President Obama with all the members of the National Security Team receiving that update on the mission against Osama bin Laden in the Situation Room. Everyone has talked about Hillary Clinton in that photo. She's in the foreground. Her hand is covering her mouth. I hardly have to describe it because I think all of our listeners have seen it. And of course, now Hillary Clinton says she doesn't remember that precise moment. She had allergies. She was probably coughing. But whatever the truth of the matter, the real question is how she fits in to the Obama administration. You've said that she has a good relationship with President Obama. But there is the larger national security team and the nature of the relationship that Obama has with Vice President Biden, who, of course, has an exemplary record in foreign policy and plays a key role with President Obama. Say a little bit more about what that image says to you, if anything, and Secretary Clinton's role in the operation last week, whether she enjoys the Obama bounce, as it's been called, as a result of this, or whether perhaps some of her capital has dropped.
Well, I don't think her capital has dropped. I mean, I think the administration in general has enhanced. That was a terribly nerve-wracking 40 minutes when they were waiting to find out what was going to happen after the helicopter crashed at the compound. And President Obama on 60 Minutes last night described it as the most nerve-wracking period of his life since his younger daughter, Sasha, was taken to the emergency room when she was a few months old with what they were worried was meningitis, and they weren't sure, you know, what was going to happen to her. And it was one of those kinds of moments. So it would be totally natural that this would be something that would have Hillary Clinton and the rest of the people in the room looking that way. One of the things that struck me is that image did photographically what I tried to do both in this Vanity Fair piece about Hillary and then in The Promise about the president, which was to take you behind the closed doors of the Situation Room. That's where we all want to be, and that's the focus certainly of my reporting. And what it indicated is that, you know, Hillary Clinton in some cases was not successful. She wanted the White House to stop issuing statements undermining Hosni Mubarak, and the president said no. On other occasions, she's very influential. what is, and so on Libya, for instance, you know, her views, which favored a no-fly zone from an early point, ended up carrying the day. What's interesting, among many other interesting things about this president, is that he actually lets his people argue it out, sometimes in public. So Hillary Clinton and Bob Gates, for instance, had a very different view of what to do in Afghanistan, as I mentioned, and it was known publicly. When Leon Panetta last week wanted those photographs released of bin Laden after he was shot, he was overruled, but he was able to express his opinion not just behind closed doors, but on television. Then there are other things, especially that relate more to, you know, kind of personnel matters, that the president is very insistent do not come out publicly. And so when they're revealed, you know, when people like me have them in books and magazine articles, they're not happy about it. So what you try to do is paint a complex picture. There's, for instance, there was a sense, Jamie, that was reported early on that it was the women against the men on Libya, that the women wanted to bomb Libya and the men did not. And, you know, I talked to some people who said that's just a gross oversimplification. And you know, treating as Anne-Marie Slaughter, who was the director of policy planning at the State Department, told me, you know, that's like saying that the women were all had been touchy-feely in favor of focus on women and children's issues, and then suddenly became Valkyrite, Amazonian warmongers, you know, overnight. She said, please, you know, that's ridiculous. So there's a subtlety to these relationships that are all of, you know, have all had their ups and downs, including Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton's relationship. Yeah. But they all, basically, they work as a team, and I think there's less dissension in this administration than in any since probably George H.W. Bush's, you know, in the early 1990s.
And, of course, now the administration will have to look forward in its relationship with Pakistan, which will be a difficult one, to say the least, always has been. But now in the wake of the killing of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, here is what Hillary Clinton had to say.
It is not always an easy relationship. You know that. But on the other hand, it is a productive one for both of our countries. And we are going to continue to cooperate between our governments, our militaries, our law enforcement agencies, but most importantly, between the American and Pakistani people.
So there is Hillary Clinton acknowledging the relationship with Pakistan, not easy, but productive, her words. We give Pakistan billions in aid every year. Marwan Bashara, could Pakistan prove to be the thorniest issue for Secretary of State Clinton going forward?
Yes, I think it is. Not only for Secretary Clinton, I think it's for the Obama administration and, frankly, for the United States and its interests in the greater, so-called Greater Middle East. And that's because of a major, some would like to call it a misunderstanding or ignorance. I would like to refer to it as a mistaken strategy. That treats Pakistan as if it was periphery of Afghanistan rather than the opposite. Yeah. That doesn't truly take Pakistan's complexity and Pakistan's national security interests in calculation while formulating policy towards that part of the world. And I mean by that that Pakistan does have historically national security interest in Afghanistan, and of course the historic disagreement, if you will, or more with India over Kashmir and other big strategic questions. The fact that none of that is taken into consideration, and the fact that Pakistan, a nuclear power with over 160 million people, has been treated as such, I think will end up perhaps making out of Pakistan a far more dangerous country situation than we've ever seen in Afghanistan.
And we had the author of Pakistan, A Hard Country on, Anatol Levin, last week. And he said there is a fundamental lack of understanding, not just of what you've described, sort of an inverse misunderstanding of Pakistan vis-a-vis Afghanistan, which I think he agreed with also, but a lack of understanding of the internal workings of Pakistan, the tribal relationships, sort of an on-the-ground understanding of the country from within on the part of everyone in Washington. Would you agree with that, Marwan?
Well, yes, and if you allow me, and please don't misunderstand what I'm about to say, but I also feel you lose me on any show as soon as you start saying about how Joe Biden has an exemplary record in foreign policy and how Hillary Clinton is terrific, and how this is President Obama. I find it very difficult dealing with that, with all the disasters on America's hands.
Well, please, we have you on to express your view, so
yeah,
this is your opportunity.
I hardly was giving a view that they. I think I mentioned a couple of times, Marwan, for the record, that they've made a number of errors, although I don't take nearly as negative a view as they do, and certainly currently, as you do, I think the burden is on Pakistan to explain, not as a clarification, but a real accounting of how they could have let Osama bin Laden, the most wanted man in the world, live among them for close to 6 years. So the burden is now on Pakistan. We've given them $20 billion in aid in the last decade, and I think the American people and the American Congress are perfectly within their rights to want some answers.
All right, so fair enough. So, Marwan, you have two questions now. You have one from Jonathan Alter. Do you agree that the burden is on Pakistan to explain that in light of the billions of dollars in aid since 9/11? And then I had the primary question for you, which actually I think cuts in the direction you want to go, about our lack of understanding, of rudimentary understanding of the way in which Pakistan works internally. So why don't you take Jonathan's question first about, and I think they we're starting to get some acknowledgement from Pakistan that they have some questions to answer, right?
You see, I have the luxury sitting in Al Jazeera, but also coming from academic background, not to need in any shape or form to take sides.
Yes.
I don't take sides with Pakistan, and I don't take sides with the United States, presumably because I'm a journalist, but more importantly, as a citizen of the world, I have first and foremost probe power, the misuse, the use, and the overuse of power. And in this instance, the use, misuse, and the overuse of power, especially military power, has been done by the United States and Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
I have absolutely no respect and certainly no love lost for the Pakistan military establishment. And I certainly have no love lost for America's mistakes, if you want to call them that way, in the Greater Middle East, in Pakistan and Afghanistan, that lead to the death of thousands upon thousands of people, not to mention Iraq and not to mention other places. So from this very comfortable position of not needing to take a stand, it's very important for the American public opinion, of course, and for the American people to understand that neither they nor I nor Jonathan need to choose between bin Laden and Bush, between Obama and the Pakistan leadership, whoever they are, whether they are military or civilians. We don't need to choose between Mubarak and Netanyahu. We don't need to choose between Bin Ali and Bin Laden. All of these are false choices. These are false choices. The people in the United States, like the people in Pakistan, don't have to make a choice and take sides between Pakistan, the military establishment, and Washington, that is conducting three wars, including continuous drone attacks in Pakistan. I think if the Pakistani military was conducting drone attacks in the United States around Washington and New York, trust me, the American people would not trust whatever would come out of Islamabad.
But you are suggesting that Americans should ask questions about how their tax dollars are being spent, Marwan.
Especially, I mean, that's the thing. You see, in Pakistan and in Iraq and Egypt and these sorts of places, because of the lack of democracy, people are not as responsible for their foreign policy as they are in the United States. And that's why the American people are responsible for what their government do, because they elect them and or they re-elect them or elect someone else. And hence, it is even more it's more important for the American people to be fair and to be knowledgeable and to make sure that their sentiment is heard in Washington. And I would like to, by the way, always distinguish between Washington and the rest of America, because in
yes.
Washington, as we all know, there's enough of special interests that affect policy on the short time anyway, and that in the rest of America there are far more reasonable people with probably the oldest and the most mature democracy in the world to know that at the end of the day there's a certain foreign policy that does create havoc and damage in places like, for example, as we know now, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan,
now,
and so on and so forth.
Now, we could all three debate these many questions all afternoon, but or I guess I should say for the rest of the morning, but sadly I have time constraints, and I see that we at least all agree that Pakistan is a sticky wicket for the State Department. I think that's probably where we will have to leave Pakistan. I have to quickly ask you, Marwan, about Libya and where you see that going.
Unfortunately, it is being complicated. It's getting complicated in Libya in a way that, of course, none of us have hoped. The Arab Spring is heating up, and unfortunately, in Libya as well as in Syria, in Yemen, and of course, it did so in Bahrain. So in so many ways, I think we're all sobering up from the Arab Spring, if you will, or from that dream come through in Egypt and Tunisia. Now, not only in Libya, mostly, as you will ask, that it is sort of now the hottest and the most violent, if you will, in the region, with people in Misrata and other places being bombarded daily. I think there is a bit of a stalemate now, and I think in so many ways NATO is trying to bombard its way out of the stalemate. On the short term, I think Gaddafi is losing whatever storage, if you will, he has, and whatever arms he has, and whatever little support he has within certain quarters of the capital in Tripoli. So hopefully, time is not playing in Gaddafi's favor, that eventually the people in Libya will win over this thing. It's going to be, of course, it is already quite costly, but they will go through it, and I hope as well that the same thing will play for Yemen in the next few days. So maybe when we talk next time, Yemen and Libya would be liberated, or maybe not.
Oh, or on the way. And Jonathan Alter, I have a question for you, a very different final question for you. It is about Hillary Clinton, because everyone sort of wonders what's next for her. She can't really run for president until 2016. One presumes she wouldn't challenge Barack Obama. So will she do that, or does she want a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court ultimately? You know, Secretary of State is, for most people, a pretty good end game. But, you know, one sense is with Hillary Clinton that it's just a step on the way to something else, something bigger. What do you think?
Well, she has said that that this is her last public job. She'll leave in 2013 and work on do nonprofit work. She's already been involved in Vital Voices and other organizations with a particular interest in women and children. And I take her at her word on that. But I do think that there's still a distinct possibility that in 2016 she will be the Democratic candidate for president. I don't think the Supreme Court is in her future. They like to name them younger than that nowadays, so they have a longer time on the court, and she's 63. But she'll be 68 in 2016, a young 68, and I don't think we've heard the last of her. I think the idea of ambition and the Clintons, those two notions will go together for quite a while yet.
All right. Well, thanks to you both, gentlemen. Marwan Bashar, senior political analyst for Al Jazeera English, host of Empire, and Jonathan Alter. Thanks much. You can read Jonathan Alter's profile of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in this week's Vanity Fair. And up next, if you haven't had enough controversy in the last segment, the controversy of CUNY and the decision not to award Tony Kushner an honorary diploma. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. We'll be right back.